Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, David Talbot, believes we are in the beginnings of a new movement in the United States. But first, we have to break widespread ignorance about the U.S.-led war on terror, which he says is the biggest generator of terror around the world. The war on terror has created a perpetual war machine that's created more enemies than it's eliminated. The backstory to everything we're grappling with today is lost in history, and that's why David Talbot wrote his latest book, The Devil's Chessboard, Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. It tells the story of Allen Dulles, the father of modern U.S. intelligence, and perhaps the most ruthless practitioner of power that the American elite has ever produced. In 1947, the Senate Armed Services Committee asked Allen Dulles to share his vision for a strong central intelligence agency, and this would pave the way for the creation of the CIA later that year. Allen Dulles was the longest-serving director of the CIA from 1953 to 1961, and according to the CIA, those were the golden years. Mind control, torture, political assassination, and mass surveillance were among the common tools used under Dulles's reign. David Talbot is author of the New York Times bestseller, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the national bestseller, Season of the Witch. David is founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon. His latest book is The Devil's Chessboard, Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. And David joins me here in studio. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Great to be back, Rose. Thank you.
It's great to have you back. Wow, what a book, 700-plus pages.
Yeah, well, I had to write it.
Well, there's so much information in this book. It came out a couple of months ago, and I've been watching you on independent media outlets. You've given a lot of talks, but you haven't gotten much attention in the national media.
No, it's been frustrating. You know, my earlier books, including Season of the Witch, did get wide acclaim and wide reviews in the press, the East Coast media as well, Washington Post, Boston Globe, and so on. And this book got early pre-pub, buzz going. Kirkus Reviews, which is the book industry publication, gave it a rave review, a starred review. Amazon named it a book of the month. And so the pre-pub publicity was quite, encouraging. But as soon as it came out, the major media gatekeepers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, even Al Jazeera America, told my book publisher, quote, we're not going to touch this book. And when Al Jazeera, I was all lined up to go on Al Jazeera America, which is no longer with us, I guess, in New York. I was literally in a car being driven in Manhattan to the studio, and my publicist gets a email saying it's off, it's been canceled. And when he emailed back, why? One word response, politics. The New York Times book review editor, Pamela Paul, told my publisher's representative to her face, no, we're not going to touch this. And look, this is because these major media companies are part of the problem. They were part of the national security state under Allen Dulles. They continue to carry water for our national security agenda in many ways. We can blame the New York Times, of course, in part, for the war in Iraq because of its coverage of the so-called WMDs, the non-existent WMDs in Iraq. So, this collaboration between the national security state and our top corporate media has a long history. It goes back to the days of Allen Dulles, and it continues to this day.
And this also speaks to one of the main points you make about why you wrote this book, and that is, in many cases, the truth about all of these issues is just too raw to process.
Well, absolutely. Look, I mean, this in many ways is the business of America. War is the business of America. It used to be a situation where part of our economy had been militarized to the extent that President Eisenhower, as he was leaving the White House, gave his famous farewell address warning the country about the so-called military-industrial complex. Well, now the entire economy has been virtually militarized. There are so many companies, there are so many facets of our enterprise, American enterprise, that are touched in some way or involved in some way in national security. Look at Silicon Valley. I mean, some of the most leading minds in Silicon Valley and some of its greatest resources are devoted to national security. Ed Snowden, among others, tried to wake us up to this, the growth of this incredible corporate surveillance state. And much of it, by the way, is privatized. It's not all federal. And much of it, as I said, is in Silicon Valley, right down the highway.
You talk about the fact that Americans need to come to grips with the war on terror. And in order to do that, we need to learn more about history and how we got here.
Exactly. And that's why the Allen Dulles period is so key. He was like Dick Cheney on steroids, I call him. He was America's most legendary spy master. His career actually goes back all the way to World War I in Switzerland. He was part of a very illustrious, powerful family, the Dulles family. His older brother, John Foster Dulles, was the top lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell, which was the most powerful Wall Street law firm through much of the 20th century. Allen Dulles was a junior partner there, became a senior partner. And the two of them were this dynamic duo throughout their careers. Part of what the C. Wright Mills, the famous sociologist from the Cold War period, called the power elite. These were powerful men, and they were almost 99% men, who, you know, had roots in Wall Street, in corporate America, and then made the transition to Washington. And they shuttled easily between those two worlds, Wall Street and Washington. The worlds, of course, that Bernie Sanders and his movement is targeting today, and for good reason. So these have been the power centers in America for much of the last 100 years, really, the last century.
When did you start reading about Allen Dulles or hearing about him? Because even in circles where people talk a lot about security or Edward Snowden or the deep security state, you don't often hear Allen Dulles' name.
No, you know, most people know Dulles just from the airport in Washington. And, of course, that's not named after Allen. It's named after his brother, John Foster, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower while Allen ran the CIA. Well, I became interested in Allen Dulles through the Kennedy story. Mm-hmm. I wrote an earlier book called Brothers that was about Bobby Kennedy's search for the truth about what happened to his brother in Dallas. And in the course of doing that research, I came up with a revisionist perspective on the Kennedy presidency. You know, it had been commonly sort of thought of in scholarly circles as kind of a macho administration, sort of these Cold Warrior, young Cold Warriors starting the Green Berets, getting us involved in Vietnam and all that. But the truth is that John F. Kennedy was very dedicated to the cause of peace. He was very, very anxious about the possibility of a nuclear war that would destroy the world, and he devoted much of his administration to trying to seek a peaceful rapprochement with Khrushchev in Moscow and with Fidel Castro in Havana, finally. And as a result of those efforts, there was major blowback from the national security state. And what I write about in Brothers is essentially the Kennedy presidency broke in two over the Cold War. And that's where I became more and more interested in Allen Dulles. Now, Allen Dulles, who was faithfully kept on by Kennedy from the Eisenhower period as director of CIA, because Kennedy feels he needs this kind of continuity. He's a young president. He's only won by a thin margin. Keeps Allen Dulles on. But it was a fateful decision. And within months, they have a major conflict. And as I write in my new book, the conflict is not over simply the Bay of Pigs, which has been commonly known as the first fracture between Dulles and the CIA and Kennedy, where the CIA mounts this invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. It's a disaster. The CIA and the Pentagon want Kennedy then to launch an all-out invasion with U.S. military firepower. Kennedy refuses to do that, and it becomes one of the greatest fiascos in CIA history. Well, as I write in the book, that was going on at the same time that the CIA was trying to overthrow an ally of ours in France, President Charles de Gaulle in France, who they felt was, inviting a Soviet takeover of Algeria by trying to settle the French colonial war there, and was too stubbornly nationalistic. So here you have young John Kennedy grappling with these two CIA disasters in the same month, shortly after he's inaugurated. So I was fascinated by this because essentially what this told me as I really dug deep into the Kennedy presidency is no matter who we elect as president, there's a power, a center of power, national security, that continues no matter who happens to be in the White House.
This was such a fascinating part of your book and raised so many questions about what we're dealing with today. But going back to that time, Around the time of JFK, you write that the limits of his own power were brought home time and time again. And even after JFK fired Dulles in 1961, you write about the fact that Dulles apparently didn't get the memo. He went home to Georgetown, and he continued to operate as if he were still running the CIA.
Yeah, this is another headline. And we were talking earlier, Rose, about the media ignoring the book. This should have been a major story in the press. This was a major revelation in my book. So here you have this charismatic president who's become a hero and an icon in our life, President John Kennedy, firing the head of the CIA because of these disasters involving French and CIA activities in France and Cuba. And, right, he is fired. He goes home to his home in Georgetown, but he continues to operate as if he's still running the agency. His top lieutenants, men like Richard Helms, the famous James Jesus Angleton, who was head of CIA counterintelligence, they all continue to come to Dulles' home on a regular basis as if they're still reporting to him. In fact, the man who Kennedy put in his place after he fired Dulles, John McCone, was a Republican businessman from California, was not a CIA old boy. He was not deeply connected or wired in the agency. And mainly he was seen as a figurehead within the agency. So it was Alan Dulles, after he was fired by Kennedy, who continued, I believe, to run the agency throughout the Kennedy presidency.
And his advisor, JFK's advisor, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., told you, "We did not control the Pentagon nor clearly the CIA."
Well, yeah, there's another chilling observation. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., of course, was one of the great historians of the 20th century, from Harvard historian, Pulitzer Prize winner, and became an advisor, a White House advisor to Kennedy, and of course wrote, you know, A Thousand Days, which is a great chronicle of the Kennedy presidency. And I interviewed Schlesinger before his death, and he did, in fact, tell me that we did not control the CIA or the Pentagon. I mean, again, what a startling statement for a high-level White House advisor and historian at that to tell me years later that the Kennedy presidency was a very limited presidency in that respect.
And what has changed? I mean, this is a big question, but what has changed since then? Because it's been striking that these issues have really not come up at all in the presidential debates. Well, or look, even in the conversations.
Well, you know, to be blunt about it, I think the people who did get the memo after November 22nd, 1963, in Dallas, when the President of the United States, riding through the streets of an American city in an open car, you know, not to be too blunt about it, has his brain splattered all over his wife, mm-hmm. I think that sends a signal down through the ages to one president after the next. And I know for a fact that virtually every American president since Kennedy has been fascinated by what the true story is of the Kennedy assassination, has asked for the secret files. I know Clinton did, Bill Clinton, among others, had his attorney general, Webster Hubbell at the time, look into it for him. And, of course, they hit the same roadblocks that most of us do when we investigate this. Even if you're president, it's above your pay grade to know certain secrets about the American government. But, look, I think they did, you know, get that message. Anyone who, decides to go into public life at that level of power, who runs for the White House, who runs to be the commander-in-chief in control of this vast national security apparatus, soon discovers the limits of how much control he, because I've been he so far, has over this vast machinery of violence, and can only challenge it at their own peril.
Do you think this quote from Schlesinger still applies today? We do not control the Pentagon, nor clearly the CIA?
Well, I think we even saw inklings of this in the Obama administration. I think President Obama tried to live up to his word. I think he did try to withdraw from the Middle East, these permanent wars that go on and on and on in one part of the world, and mostly in the Middle East these days. I think he did try to shut down Guantanamo, but yet they're still going. The wars are still going. Guantanamo is still in operation. We know from certain books that have come out, Michael Hastings' book, the late Michael Hastings, that there were these serious conflicts between the top Pentagon command and Obama over issues of, like, troop levels and withdrawing of troops from Afghanistan and elsewhere. And yet he didn't win. This is something that I think presidents, it's like a it's like, a fact of life. It's like gravity. If you become president of the United States, you have to accept certain laws, and that's one of them, that America will be permanently at war because war is America's business.
David Talbot is author of the new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David says in order to understand the true imperial history of the United States, we need to analyze former CIA director Alan Dulles' legacy. And if you have any questions for David Talbot about his massive new book that is full of so much fascinating information about the history of the CIA and former CIA Alan Dulles, who served from 1953 to 1961. We'd love to hear from you. This is a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls. Join us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Questions do you have about how the CIA operates and the power that they have over our democracy? And also, when we say they, who's they? That's the other question.
Well, right. They. I don't want to make Dulles out to be the supervillain who's doing this all by himself.
Right.
He, of course, there was his brother, for one thing, Foster, who was a very powerful man in his own right, Secretary of State under Eisenhower, and this very powerful Wall Street lawyer. And there was their circle. These were men who would meet within organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, which is still a very influential institution based in New York. These were top corporate executives, top people from the media, bankers, national security people. And they essentially meet in these informal surroundings at clubs like the organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations to work out their policy. And then whatever that policy is gets implemented then later in Washington. So it's a circle of power. And, in Dulles' day, the Rockefeller brothers, Nelson Rockefeller, David Rockefeller, the banker, Nelson, who became governor of New York, were also very powerful members of this group and very close to the Dulles brothers. In fact, when Alan Dulles, as CIA director, wanted to finance something off the books, so to speak, he sometimes had an intermediary sit down for lunch with David Rockefeller, who would then write him a check to finance some black bag CIA job. So it was a very cohesive, tight world. They belonged to the same clubs. Their kids went to the same schools. This is the way that a ruling class works. And, of course, we like to think of the ruling class as just Downton Abbey. It's some European thing. But, of course, America has its own ruling class, and whether you call it the power elite, as C. Wright Mills did, or the deep state, as scholars like Peter Dale Scott call it, that is how it works.
And you chose the name The Devil's Chessboard because Alan and his brother were like obsessive chess players and treated people like they were pawns in their game?
Absolutely. In fact, when Alan Dulles was engaged to be married, he famously ignored his wife-to-be, Clover, who was a very interesting woman in her own right, very artistic, very sensitive, very intelligent woman, for hours while he went at it with his brother over the chessboard. And they looked at the world that way. They looked at the world as their chessboard, whether it was a democratic government in Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, government that they overthrew with great disastrous results that we're feeling to this day, or the democratic government in Guatemala or Congo, or as I say, with I think, and this is the most controversial part of my book, whether it's our own government here that they target, the Kennedy presidency. These are men who feel that the world is their chessboard.
We have full lines, David, so let's go to callers. Let's hear from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. On Jefferson Morley's website, there's a different interpretation of the relationship between Robert Kennedy and Alan Dulles offered by Philip Shannon, who believes, the Warren Commission report interpretation. And he claims that Robert Kennedy, instead of being an enemy of Alan Dulles, offered, effusive praise after they got rid of him as CIA director. And also, he claims that in the LBJ library, there's a memo from Johnson A. that claims that Robert Kennedy was consulted about membership of the Warren Commission and suggested Alan Dulles. I'd like to know what your reaction is.
Yeah, I think Phil Shannon, who's a former New York Times reporter and did, as you say, write a book about the Warren Commission a couple years ago, unfortunately sort of took the CIA disinformation line in many ways as he was writing that book. And one of the oldest, I think, lies about the Warren Report and the makeup of the Warren Commission, rather, is that Bobby Kennedy, of all people, lobbied somehow Lyndon Johnson to have Alan Dulles, a longtime political enemy of the Kennedys, put on the Warren Commission. This is simply untrue, and I write about this in my book. I show that, in fact, it was the CIA and colleagues of Alan Dulles, like Richard Helms and others, who lobbied President Johnson strenuously to have Dulles put on the commission. Bobby had nothing to do with it. And in fact, Bobby was in a very painful position because, as he later said, he thought the Warren Report was a propaganda exercise. But he, as obviously as the torchbearer for the Kennedy family and someone that the entire sort of media spotlight was constantly on, he knew that if he came out publicly at that point, and while he was still Attorney General and then later a senator from New York, and attacked the Warren Report, that all hell would have broken loose, and that he would have to back that up with his own investigation and with his own interpretation of what happened to his brother. Now, he was, as I write about in my earlier book, Brothers, secretly doing just that. He was sending out every investigator he could, men like Walter Sheridan, who had been a longtime investigator for him, a former FBI guy, looking to every kind of lead that he could track down on the murder of his brother. And as I make a strong case for in my book Brothers, Bobby intended to reopen the investigation into his brother's death if he had been elected president in 1968. I believe that Bobby was killed basically by the same forces that killed his brother, and we can go into that if you want. I know Sirhan Sirhan today was up for another parole hearing, I believe, so maybe it's a timely moment to discuss Bobby's assassination. Right. But in any case, there's lots of misinformation that has been put out about the killings of both Kennedy brothers over the years, and when you track down some of this information back to its source, it often comes from the CIA directly.
Well, thank you for calling in, Frank. Let's go next to Ray in El Cerrito. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks. Thanks for this guest. This is a really fascinating subject. And he was talking earlier about the corporatization of American policy and how we go to war. And it just reminded me of a book I read in college called Wizards of Armageddon by Fred Kaplan, who's now a writer for Slate.
Great book.
And it was a fascinating book. It really changed a lot of the way how I saw things in foreign policy. And you bring up a lot of the same themes, but you seem to go farther back in time than he did. To really sort of get through the early beginnings of this. And I was just curious, has there always been this tradition of a sort of making a war seem inevitable and seem like it could be done on the cheap with a minimal cost of blood and effort, and then sort of overselling how easy the war is and then wind up reaping horrible consequences afterwards? It just seems like that's an ongoing story, and it doesn't really seem to change. All that seems to change is that we experience it rather than read about it in history.
Well, I think you put your finger on it. In fact, yes, it does have a long, long history. It goes back to, I believe, the beginning of the rise of the U.S. Empire, which is the Spanish-American War. And, of course, we all remember, or most of us should remember from our studies, that war was precipitated by an act of terror, the blowing up of the USS Maine in the harbor in Havana that we blamed on the dastardly Spanish. And later, it turned out that it was probably just an accident, that munitions had blown up that were being stored on the ship. But, of course, just like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, then that LBJ uses as a pretext for expanding the war in Vietnam, or the so-called WMDs that, the Bush-Cheney administration exploited the lie that Saddam was manufacturing, weapons of mass destruction. And the New York Times, of course, fell for that hook, line, and sinker. Again and again, these excuses that are manufactured by the national security state, and the press does not do enough of its job to look through these lies and disinformation. And, bringing it back to the corporate kind of basis for a lot of these wars, when you look at some of the key things that Allen Dulles and his brother did when they were running the national security state throughout much of the Cold War, the countries they targeted, they first blamed these leaders, these democratically elected leaders like Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, like Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, like Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. These were nationalist leaders. They were Democrats. They were not communists. They were not tyrants. They were not threats to American security. But that's the way that the Dulles brothers always painted them before they then went in and knocked them out. And they did that with the complicity of the American media. If you look at the atrocious coverage in the New York Times, the Washington Post, of these democratic governments in these third world countries, they always, parrot the CIA line, that these are dangerous men, they're threats to our security, they're communists. Those were complete lies, but it paved the way for these terrible disasters.
Well, after the break, I'd like you to elaborate on this, because you say that the truth is Allen Dulles hated the democracies of Iran and Guatemala for their freedom, and he terminated these democracies through force.
That's right.
So we'll talk about that after the break. Today I'm speaking with David Talbot, author of the new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm speaking with David Talbot. He is founder of Salon.com, and he's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, a national bestseller, Season of the Witch, a really great look at the history of movements in San Francisco. And his new book is The Devil's Chessboard, Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David says that the backstory to everything we're grappling with today when it comes to U.S. foreign policy and the deep state is lost in history, and that's why he wrote this book. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. about what you said before the break about how Allen Dulles, well, I said this in your words, hated the democracies of Iran and Guatemala. Can you talk specifically about Iran? Because, as you say, we are still reaping the bitter fruit of that coup.
The cover story in Iran, as in all these countries where the CIA organized these coups, was that we were dealing with dangerous leaders, tyrants, communists, people who were connected to the Soviet Union and so on. And that was, almost inevitably was a cover story, was disinformation. The reality is that in Iran, what so threatened the Dulles brothers and their circle was the fact that Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected leader of the country in the 1950s, was nationalizing oil, was finally taking control of his nation's oil. And that oil had been controlled by the company that is now British Petroleum and by U.S. Oil companies. Finally, the people of Iran said enough to this Western control of their own nation's resources. And as soon as Mossadegh announced that he was nationalizing his country's oil, then his days were numbered. The CIA and British intelligence began collaborating right away to create a loud opposition in the streets and to eventually overthrow Mohammad Mossadegh, and he spends the rest of his life under house arrest. Now, again, there's a corporate basis for all of these actions. In Guatemala, it was United Fruit Company. United Fruit was an enormously powerful agribusiness giant that controlled much of the resources of countries throughout Latin America. Particularly in the Caribbean. And so, again, this very dirt-poor country where a reform leader who's kind of like the JFK of Guatemala is elected president, Jacobo Arbenz. He has a beautiful, glamorous wife. They're a wealthy couple, but they're very dedicated to uplifting the impoverished people of their country. So he announces some very modest reforms. He says they're going to expropriate the government unused land that United Fruit owns so poor peasants can begin tilling it and supporting themselves. And this, again, initiates this sharp backlash from the CIA, from the Dulles brothers. They happen to represent, by the way, United Fruit when they were corporate lawyers. So it's all part of this, you know, sort of circle, this dark circle. And again, the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, this very charismatic young leader, emerging from this brutal colonial dictatorship under Belgium rule that Adam Hochschild, who's a wonderful local writer and historian and my former colleague at Mother Jones magazine, wrote a wonderful book called King Leopold's Ghost about how savage the Belgian colonial rule was. And so as Lumumba in the late 1950s starts to lead his country out of this brutal colonial era, he again wants to nationalize mining interests, very powerful interests, again based in New York and London and Brussels. And again, the CIA you know, jumps to action and overthrows him, and he's horribly tortured and murdered.
You know, it's so obvious that there's no answer to this question, but you have to wonder, where would we be today if these coups didn't happen, especially, well, Iran, Guatemala, the Congo?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, it created, I think, this feeling of ill will, of anger, of bitterness, for, you know, for obvious reasons, throughout much of the world against the U.S. We're seen as this bully that out of greed and, you know, the will to dominate the world, again and again, you know, crushes the aspirations, the legitimate democratic aspirations of people around the world. Now, John F. Kennedy challenged that. It's amazing if you go back, you know, we're in another presidential season, but people should read some of the speeches that candidate John F. Kennedy delivered in 1960. You know, he went to the Hotel Teresa. I write about this in the book. It's an amazing story. Hotel Teresa was a hotel in Black Harlem where Fidel Castro and his Cuban delegation were forced to go when white New York would not let him stay in any hotels when they came there in 1960 during the presidential race. So Malcolm X arranged it so Fidel Castro and his delegation could stay there. And soon after he leaves, President Kennedy shows up. And instead of denouncing the fact that this communist was right here in New York City, he says, no, Fidel Castro represents the winds of change. And Americans have to embrace these winds, too. He also says, you know, we're standing in a community where these African-American children will have much less opportunity than young white children who are growing up. And we can't have that either. Later, as president, he goes on to deliver some remarkable speeches, speeches saying that we're only a small percentage of the world's population. We cannot control the world's resources. We cannot repress the world's will to be free. And, of course, it culminates in, I think, his most beautiful speech of all in June 1963, the so-called peace speech he delivers at American University, where he says, you know, we've all been taught to hate the Soviet Union, the communists, but we all love our children, we all breathe the same air, and we all cherish our children's future. We need to live together. Imagine even President Obama, as eloquent as he can be, saying the same thing about, you know, militant Islam today. He just wouldn't be allowed to say it. You know, so President Kennedy was a visionary in many ways. He was ahead of his time in trying to push the world away from the nuclear precipice towards peace and towards a world where the United States was not the dominant bully, but learned to live in a kind of multilateral way with the rest of the world.
Hmm. David Talbot is author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government. And let's go back to callers. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call. I'd like to know, was Eisenhower's appointment of Alan Dulles to head up CIA and John Foster Dulles to be his Secretary of State, was that the two worst appointments he could possibly make? Could he have appointed some other people? Because it seems the appointment of both of those men set the stage for the rest of the 20th century, and all the blowback we've had from all their blunders that they've made. Could Eisenhower have appointed someone else than those two men? Because they were obviously the two worst appointments he could possibly make.
Well, I think you're right, and they were very fateful appointments because those two men essentially controlled Eisenhower's foreign policy and national security. You know, there was a wonderful quote I read from Eisenhower's son, John, who served with him in the White House as a young aide at the time. And he said his dad, even though he'd been around the world and he was obviously a general and a war hero, president of Columbia University, was actually a fairly unsophisticated guy when it came down to it. You know, a guy from Kansas. He wasn't a product of the Ivy League like the Dulles brothers. And there is class in America. And when it came to that, you know, Eisenhower is really out of his league in many ways, dealing with these Ivy League-bred CIA Wall Street types. And he deferred to them. And he kind of was enamored of them in a way. He liked to play golf with wealthy corporate guys. Kennedy made fun of that later. Of course, Kennedy, you know, came from his own wealthy family. But I think basically what Ike did was to outsource his administration in a large part to the Dulles brothers. He deferred to them. He thought they had much more experience. He thought that he had to follow their lead. Now, towards the end of his administration, I think he became very upset. Foster's now dead. Alan, he died of stomach cancer late in the second term. But Alan is still very much in power. And I believe there's good evidence to show that Ike's last attempt to establish peace with the Soviet Union was sabotaged by the shoot-down of the U-2 spy plane over Russia. And there's a number of people who believe, including Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the Air Force liaison with the CIA at the time, that Alan Dulles and the CIA basically arranged it so the U-2 plane would be vulnerable and would be shot down on the eve of the Geneva summit between Russia and the United States. And this, of course, was sort of, Ike's last chance at peace with Khrushchev. And he later said famously, as he was leaving, he was very bitter towards Alan Dulles, that Dulles had left him a legacy of ashes.
Well, thank you for the phone call, John. Let's go next to Kurt in Monterey. Hi, Kurt. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Hi, David. Listen, I've got to ask you, a lot of people, David, tend to dismiss books like this, stories like this, as conspiratorial, in that if there was a vast conspiracy, that it would collapse of its own weight, somebody would come and spill the beans, et cetera, et cetera. Do these men, you know, likely a handful of psychopaths, do they really require a vast conspiracy, or is it just them working their will and lying to everyone else?
See, I think a man like Alan Dulles is a psychopath, and my book goes into some specific examples of that involving his own family. For instance, he put his own son at one point, who came back from the Korean War with a brain injury, in the hands of CIA scientists, the infamous MK Ultra program, where they did brain experiments on people. So, yeah, I mean, I think you can make a strong case for Alan Dulles being personally a psychopath. Hmm. But I think there's a psychopathology to power. And what I'm trying to talk about here is this is a complex of power and of corporate interests and strategic interests. And it wasn't just Alan Dulles. He was part of a circle, as I said, of these very powerful men, the Rockefeller brothers, people they served with in government, another Wall Street banker named Doug Dillon, who later became Secretary of Treasury under JFK, also served with and, by the way, was in charge of Kennedy's Secret Service. And we could talk about maybe that in Dallas later. But so I don't want, again, to just single out Alan Dulles as a peculiar case. he was very representative of American power during the Cold War and this arrogance of American power. And we're still living with the legacy of that today. These were men coming out of World War II, America having, you know, such a dominant position in the world after European economies had been devastated, the Soviet Union losing over 20 million dead. You know, we had a nuclear monopoly. We were in such a, I think, a superior position coming out of World War II that this elite group that ran the country felt they should take full advantage of it, and they did.
What do you think are the main differences between that elite group and the elite group today? Because under the Bush administration, the CIA director spoke on a regular basis. Obama's CIA director, John Brennan, I mean, you rarely hear him speak in public. I would guess that a lot of people don't even know his name.
Absolutely. There's more of a kind of banality and invisibility to, I think, the national security state today. James Clapper, who's heard of him, the head of our national intelligence. You're right, John Brennan, who with Obama makes these fateful decisions for every week who to kill through our drone assassination program. You know, so there was more of a face to U.S. National security state during the Dulles time. In fact, that was maybe if there were any things that were better about the old days, that's one of them. At least you could see, oh, that's, you know, Alan Dulles. He's a very powerful guy. He was on the cover of Time magazine. He did have a high profile. And he liked that, too. He had an ego. But, you know, today it's become, I think, so institutionalized and so pervasive and so systemic, the way that the national security complex operates in this country, the vast surveillance that we're subjected to, as I said, not just by government agencies, but by private industry. Ed Snowden has warned us about. You know, it's become so embedded in American life now that it's hard to actually point to any particular one group of people who are responsible for this. And, of course, it goes from one presidency to the next uninterrupted. So we have a much more challenging, I think, task before us at this point to root out this kind of big brother kind of mentality.
I just searched John Brennan because I was just wondering, what are these guys saying these days? Because you just don't hear them. He testified in front of a Senate committee yesterday saying that the violence and instability in the Middle East was the worst it had been in 50 years, according to this piece by a Business Insider, painting a dire picture of a region he said was facing unprecedented bloodshed.
Right. And, of course, that's exactly what Dick Cheney's role was and Donald Rumsfeld before, you know, creating these boogeymen, the constant threats, the constant, you know, keeping people on the edge of their seats. That's what, of course, we now learned yesterday was one of the motivating factors behind Donald Trump's support. And, of course, he's great at, of course, playing on people's fears as well and creating scapegoats and you know sort of ratcheting up the terror level in this country. And you know that is the basis of for the permanent war state. These men derive enormous profit and enormous power from this, and there's a reason why they're trying to constantly keep us in this terror state. You know, C. Wright Mills wrote about this years ago, again the great sociologist who wrote The Power Elite back in the 1950s. He says such men as these have, you know, for the first time, we're talking about an emergency without end. This is back in the Cold War. This is the same today. An emergency without end. In the name of reality or realism, because they can see the world the way it really is, they've created a paranoid reality all their own that we're all forced to live within. That was C. Wright Mills back in the 1950s. It's not changed at all today.
David Talbot is author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government. This book is 700-plus pages, and you have so much information in here. What was the research project like?
Well, I want to give a shout-out to my research colleague, Karen Croft, who maybe is listening. She's lives in San Francisco, and Karen and I have worked together on all my books. I couldn't have done it without her. They are enormous research enterprises. In this case, it involved traveling overseas. It involved going to several libraries, presidential archives, you know, filing freedom of information requests with the CIA, because, of course, the CIA is still, in defiance of federal law, withholding you know, hundreds of key documents related to the Kennedy assassination. So it's and interviewing people. One of the most fascinating aspects of this is when you do find someone who's still living, in this case, Alan Dulles' daughter, Joan Dulles, who is a retired therapist living in Santa Fe. Remarkable woman, very thoughtful, trying to grapple with this history that swept through her living room, literally, and at the age of 90, trying to make sense of it.
Wow.
And, you know, much of the personal insight I got into Alan Dulles as a man came from the interviews that Karen and I were able to do in Santa Fe and afterwards with Joan. And the sons and daughters of other CIA officials like James Angleton. So it's a massive enterprise. It's like, you know, running a business in some ways, lining up the interviews, doing all the research, flying around the country. And you know, as I said, Karen Croft was a very important part of that.
We got a tweet from someone who says, David makes great points, but a lot of what he's saying sounds exaggerated and far-fetched.
Was that from Langley? Well, look, you can read my book. Speaking of research, it's all thoroughly documented, heavily footnoted book. You know, I'm a trained journalist and historian. I've been doing this throughout my whole life. I'm 64 years old. No one who's reviewed this book has been able to knock down even some of the more controversial allegations that I make, assertions. It's solid. It's solid, solid work. And the fact that the American media has ignored it says more about the American media than it does about the book.
We have a couple questions about what we're dealing with today. Art writes in, do you think any of the presidential candidates could suggest a way to reverse the damage done to our democracy by the secret government you describe in your book?
I'm sorry.
Do you think any of the presidential candidates can reverse the damage that's been done?
Well, that's, boy, you know, I have this argument with my friends who are a little more skeptical, including Karen, all the time. I'm, you know, a diehard optimist, and I came into politics working for Bobby Kennedy's campaign, speaking of Bobby, in 1968 as a 16-year-old volunteer in Los Angeles, and I remember, will always remember the night he was killed. And so, boy, if anything didn't turn you off to politics, I mean, the man that you invested all your hopes and dreams in during the Vietnam War to end the Vietnam War, a war that I thought I might have to, you know, go to prison because I resisted. And when he was shot and killed that night, it crushed, you know, the hopes and dreams of thousands and thousands of people, of course, all across the country. But I persist in believing that American democracy can be saved, despite all evidence to the contrary. And even now, I'm a big Bernie Sanders supporter. I wish Bernie, you and I were talking about this earlier, Rose, would be a little more forthright in his criticism of American foreign policy and our permanent war state. But he does use words like the permanent war, and obviously he opposes that. He says that we have to have a higher bar before we send our young men and women into harm's way in the Middle East. He was very eloquent in opposing the war on the floor of Congress in Iraq. Hillary was not, of course. She went along with that war. So there are reasons to, I think, be hopeful about a Bernie Sanders presidency. But I think given, again, the powers that a truly progressive presidential candidate is up against in this country. Number one, can he make it all the way? Not just national security powers, but corporate powers. I mean, he's challenged virtually every major power center in America. And he's being kept going by this incredible, I think, energy from young people who desperately want a different future in this country for obvious reasons. But you know, number one, can he make it through the labyrinth all the way to the White House? And then if he does get to the White House with Congress opposed to him, with the media opposed to him, with, you know, the national security state opposed to him, with the major industries opposed to him in Wall Street, boy, it's going to be a tough battle.
We didn't get to talk much about this, but this is connected to what you're saying. Alan Dulles backed torture, extraordinary renditions, CIA black sites, assassinations. That all began with his long regime. Senator Sanders had told Meet the Press that he does support the drone program. Unfortunately, they didn't ask him to elaborate, so we don't know what that means exactly.
I think that's very disappointing to hear. I hadn't heard that actually, Rose. But to me, that's one of, I think, the great moral disgraces of the Obama presidency, this drone assassination program that has very little legal oversight. And this is being done in our name. We know from studies that have been done by human rights groups that most of the casualties that have resulted from the drone assassination program are civilian casualties, innocent casualties, men, women, and children, who are just blown up along with the so-called militants that we're targeting. So I think this is actually a war crime. And I think that if there ever is a judicial reckoning, the way that we had in Nuremberg, and I write about this in my book, after World War II, that the drone assassination program and the people who are responsible for it, from President Obama and John Brennan, head of the CIA, on down, should be held accountable.
David, perpetual war, I mean, after doing all this research and you focus so much of your time on these issues, another person sent an email saying, what will it take to end this perpetual war?
Again, it's down to us. The one great thing, despite the sort of the uphill battle he has, that I love about seeing the Bernie campaign, is, you know, the face of these thousands of people, particularly the young people who are pouring out, to work on his campaign. It's going to take a popular movement, grassroots movement. There's no other way. It's got to come from the ground up.
David Talbot is author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Thanks for your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Our call will rebroadcast our conversation with Professor Andres Resendez, author of The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. From the days of Columbus to the beginning of the 20th century, between 2.5 and 5 million natives were enslaved across the Americas. So why is so little known about Native American slavery, and what are the ripple effects of that legacy today? It's your call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for your call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.